Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, February 4th, 2017, which still sounds to me amazingly like something out of a science fiction novel.
Well, it may be fiction.
It may be. It could all be this.
I'm not sure how scientific it is.
It could be. It could be illusionary. You know. I mean, people running around with telephones in their pockets. Ah, come on. You can't put a telephone in a pocket. Besides that, how long would your extension wire? It would get all tangled. You know how they get all tangled up when you get very far away from the phone.
Just thinking about how when Flash Gordon was doing this face-to-face thing on his, you know, little handheld and wristwatch thing. Yeah, that's never going to happen.
It was Dick Tracy.
Dick
on the
Tracy.
Wristwatch, yes,
Dick Tracy, not Flash Gordon. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. You know, one of those old heroes. He wasn't a superhero. He was just.
Well, he was pretty close to it. He had a heck of a jawline, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach and the telephone number in here. If you'd like to come in, call in. Do us in, or whatever. And we had a caller who was going to call back. It's still 254-773-1400, and we're still here, more or less, if this is Saturday, February 4th, 2017. If it's not Saturday, February 4th, 2017, where you are, then we are probably not here. We are there.
Somewhere else.
Which is something I've been trying to do all my life, is get from here to there, but whenever I arrive at there, inevitably, it's still here, which is very frustrating sometimes, you know. So that's the way life is.
I have a piece of news.
You have a pizza?
A piece of news. Yes, a pizza news. It's about a new thing. Science has found a new thing.
Oh, I'm really glad that science found a new
third grade version of it.
Where was the new thing hidden?
It was hidden under a great deal of pressure, extreme pressure, and very, very low temperatures. So what I'm talking about here is metallic hydrogen.
Oh.
They
found it?
They made it. There's some doctors at Harvard, and this is being verified.
There's some doctors at Harvard?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? There's some PhD researchers at Harvard that created a new form of pressure change. I'm trying to make this really simple. Basically, diamond anvils and diamond – just think of like a hydraulic press, only very, very small and a lot more pressure.
Kind of like we have at the office?
More than that. It's more than 10,000 times the pressure at the center of the Earth.
Okay.
And they –
So they're going to build skyscrapers out of metallic hydrogen in the future?
No, it's better than that.
Oh, better.
What we know about metallic hydrogen is all based in theory up to this moment, because nobody's been ever able to make it. But this is good news for the economy and a lot of other things. If this can be replicated, and that's a big thing, if it can be replicated and done relatively inexpensively, when you make metallic hydrogen, it is... I hope this is the theory. You can bring its temperature back up to room level and hotter, and it stays metallic. It stays metal. Why is that important? Because it has superconductive properties, which means that it would replace all of the copper wires that we use for everything. Copper, Ohm's law is a factor of electricity. It's basically, when you're moving electromagnetic force around, there's resistance. Superconductors are really cool. I made a little pun there because they have to be very cold. It's a very nerd joke. Mm-hmm. Nobody's laughing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I got that.
Okay. A room temperature superconductor is kind of the holy grail of any kind of electronics or electricity transmission.
You're aware of the fact that they never found the Holy Grail.
Oh, yeah. That's still out there. Well, not that we know of. Somebody may be drinking out of it and not be telling the rest of
us. Actually, there is a theory that it was found and it still exists. But
right. I mean, it,
and there's this thing.
Somebody's
that
drinking
like
orange
be,
juice
right.
out of it somewhere. That
well,
could be
no, it's actually got a crack in it.
Okay. Well, it's leaking orange juice from it then.
Right.
Okay. So this concept... If you think about the wind towers out in West Texas, these huge forests of wind towers with their big arms turning, and
it causes my eyes to roll around when I think about them.
Those produce a great deal of energy, and then that energy has to be put through lines that stretch all the way back to the rest of us, which is a really long. Texas is big. We got a big state. It's kind of an understatement.
You've got a grasp of the obvious there, sir.
All of that stretch has to have power put into it to maintain the level of power. So they have to create power just to transmit the power, because the resistance is, think of it as friction or whatever. It causes some of that to leak away. Metallic hydrogen would not have that leaking. It means that you could transport power without any measurable, easily measurable loss in the transmission. It means that heat levels in a computer would go extremely low. You wouldn't have that heat associated with electronics. That heat, in large part, comes from resistance. So that's a minor little thing that happened this week.
It would damage the economy because there's an entire industry designed to make heat sinks.
Right. Yeah, exactly. All the heat sink business, you know, they would have trouble.
Yeah.
The reality, though, is that was a little event, and when you say metallic hydrogen to someone, they either giggle at you or cross their eyes or have no idea what you mean.
It's the two ifs.
What's the two ifs?
If it can be reproduced, and B, if somebody can find out how to do it for less than a gazillion dollars an ounce.
Well, the good news about this is that it is being replicated in the same lab, and that other people are attempting the replication now.
So all we need is a herd of PhDs and about a gazillion dollars worth of equipment, and we make some metallic hydrogen. The issue,
the good news is the gazillion dollars of equipment isn't really as big a gazillion dollars. If you get now that the paper's out there, the money's gonna come, because there are a lot of people that want this to happen.
I'm sincerely hoping that it happens. I think that would be really cool for my computer.
I see what you did. I see what you did. So I realize that on the surface doesn't have a lot to do with, you know, the politics of the moment and the volatility of the market, but it does have a lot to do with ongoing innovation. We're still doing it. We're still the bleeding edge out there of technology. Let's not damage that with short-sightedness. And I'm not trying to make this into a pep talk. It's more simply a statement of fact, is that we are leading the world in innovation. That means that our economy is going to continue to grow for a while.
If I can, I'd like to change the subject just a little bit. Once again, telephone number in here is 773-1400, local area code 254-773-1400. One of the executive orders that came out this week was very unclear about the fiduciary rule. And there's a lot of educated guessing going on that if the Secretary of Labor actually gets confirmed, and if the Secretary of Labor gets in place, what the Secretary of Labor will probably do with it. But there was initially the rule said, okay, we're going to put off the fiduciary rule for 180 days. And then the second rule, then they came out with a final that came out and said, nope, 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 don't put it off 180 days. Just study it and see what you can do to kill it. That was a very short summary of an executive order. But the bottom line to it is, it looks like, and this is what the analysts are saying, that the Department of Labor's fiduciary rule, now what is that, is about to be killed. Now, the fiduciary rule says, the short version, is that if somebody is messing with your IRA or your 401k, and this person is offering securities or offering to charge you for advice, they have to do so either without any conflicts of interest, working solely for you, or B, they have to issue you a contract, which you and they sign, saying that they have conflicts of interest, and if they don't properly disclose those, and if they cross the line someplace and have some other conflicts of interest, you can sue them, which sounds pretty, but right now, or without the fiduciary rule, basically if somebody says, hey, you've got a 401k, I want to roll it over. I think you ought to roll it over into this thing over here. They can, and believe me, I've seen situations like this, get, you know, let's say you had $100,000 in your 401k, they get $7,000. But that means also if you have $1 million in your 401k, they get paid $70,000 of your money, but they don't have to tell you. Well, they do in a sense, in that they give you a prospectus that nobody reads. And they basically wouldn't be allowed to do that anymore. They would have to restrict their commissions to something more favorable, which generally would be a very small commission. And they take a small amount of money out of your IRA or out of your 401k. Now, was the rule a good rule? I don't know. I mean, it was so complex and so cumbersome and so burdensome that we probably could use a better one than that. We could probably use a universal fiduciary standard like they have in the United Kingdom. But the point is, it's probably going to go away. And when it because it's going to go away, anytime you're dealing with a financial advisor, or you're dealing with somebody that is not put in writing that they are an investment advisor under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, who is going to operate solely in your best interest, the door is about to be opened saying they can do anything they consider suitable, which includes putting your IRA in some stuff that might be very, very risky and potentially low profit for you, but pays them a high commission. It's perfectly legitimate to do so. And that's where the opposition has come in, and particularly from the annuity industry, several different types of annuities that have the highest expenses and the highest risk factor are the ones that are particularly that were just basically going to be eliminated from the market. But those annuities also constitute a huge profit center for insurance companies and a huge profit center for the people who sell the insurance. Now there's securities like limited partnerships and non-traded real estate investment trusts and all, and again, these sometimes pay commissions of 14% to the company that employs the financial advisor and to the financial advisor. So these things were about to be made effectively illegal. It looks like that's going to be rolled back. That's not to say that everybody who offers to roll over your 401k into an IRA is trying to rip you off. It's just the burden. Matter of fact, it's what's called the America's Choice Act, Investment Choice Act or something in Congress. What it boils down to is this new law in Congress and the executive order from the president basically says the burden is on you to figure out what you're doing and be aware that the person who's offering you something that you can roll your 401k into may be doing something that is in anything but your best interest.
Okay. There's as is normal in our conversation, there are other pieces here, just like the other executive orders that have come out along this time period. This one is not very clear in how it's to be followed. It's very vague in its approach, and it's not directly saying the fiduciary rule goes away, which leaves a lot of doubt out there. If you're it's just kind of anybody that's ever gotten memos from two bosses that contradict each other knows that this is a difficulty. If we've got any police officers listening, this is one of those areas that they have to deal with on a regular basis. It's a very tough world because you've got laws as they're written, and then you've got judge rulings on the law that gives interpretation that may be different than the original ruling, and then you got to get trained while you're on the street to do it. This is an area with the fiduciary rule where we're not – there are regulations on the books that are scheduled to take place. We have a letter now or an executive order written by the president that doesn't contradict any of those things that are set to take place, but interpretations of them are left up to the individual regulators. That's not good for the public. It's not good for, we're talking about in the case of the police officer, if you've got a law and then a ruling on a law, it takes some time to figure out what that means and come up with the rules of how you enforce it. How do you do this? We're putting our regulators, and police officers are regulators, in a place of extreme pressure, where we've got differing opinions on what they're supposed to be done by their bosses, by the people that tell them what they have to do.
And I'm going to give some non-financial prudent advice. And that is very simple. If you're dealing with your retirement money, if you're dealing with the money that you are going to depend on for the rest of your life, there's a very, very simple rule that you can follow when it comes to someone who's providing advice. Ask them to put in writing that they will always act in your best interest as a fiduciary. Simple. Put that in writing.
Make sure you have the always act and best interest and as fiduciary. Because there are people that say they're fiduciaries that are only fiduciaries sometimes, and they don't necessarily tell you when they're not.
And it's important to say that they will at all times act as a fiduciary in your best interest. If you can get them to put that in writing, which, by the way, I'm going to have a little disclosure here. We already do that.
Yeah, that's one of our conflicts, we already act for our clients always as fiduciaries. That's how we've defined ourselves.
And we put this in writing, and we file it with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it's online, and if we violate it, you could just sue our pants off. But
I prefer to keep the pants.
Yeah, but I mean, you could sue us to the point where we wouldn't be able to afford to put pants
on.
I mean,
it's true.
So
do our jobs.
We've accepted that, and that's what an independent investment advisory firm is supposed to do. We've accepted the several laws and put ourselves under those laws, including something called ERISA, which is the Employment Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. That means we simply can't have significant conflicts of interest. We simply can't have them. In other words, we can't say that, oh, yeah, I know I'm taking your money and I say I'm working for you, but in fact, I'm getting paid by somebody else. We can't do that. Now, does that mean that everybody who gets paid by somebody else is trying to rip you off? No. There are some very honest brokers out there who are trying to do the best thing they can and are trying to be as straightforward as they can. In many cases, they don't know where all the stuff goes. They don't know where all the money comes from or goes. But I'm telling you, if you're dealing with rolling over, let's say you're at Scott & White or wherever, and you've got a big retirement account and you plan to live on it for the rest of your life, I just can't even imagine going to somebody who will not act, who will not put in writing that they and their firm will at all times act in your best interest as a fiduciary. If you go to anybody else with that, you put yourself at a high level of risk that the person who sells you a bunch of investments is going to make a lot of money, their company is going to make a lot of money, and somewhere down the road, you're not going to have very much money. That's not to say it will happen every time, not to say it happens every time, but the risk is very definitely there.
There's another shift in conversation, if you're okay with that.
Yeah.
There's been a trend in the stock market of issuing strange share classes. So, for instance, Facebook and Google are kind of well known because when their initial public offering, they issued voting class shares, basically what you would consider a normal share. But in the process, they also gave their founders a 10-time voting share. So you get 10 times the vote if you were the founder for every share that you have as a normal person. Okay, that's fine.
Which used to be illegal, but is legal now.
And that's fine. So going forward. Now Google has issued out another share class that's completely non-voting. Well, non-voting share classes have existed before, but they've been looked at as kind of a silly thing. Well, why would you have that if you can't even have anything to say to the people that are doing the thing? You're just holding it. There are reasons. There are good reasons. What were you going to say?
I was going to say this is really good reasons, but because a lot of times companies said we must have a majority of the people who own shares vote. A majority, in other words, a majority of the shares have to vote before we can do something.
But at the shareholder meetings, they don't show up.
They don't show up. They don't answer. They don't do the proxies. And as a result, they spend a tremendous amount of money trying to get their shareholders to pay enough attention to actually vote.
Okay. So, that all being said, you have less rights as a shareholder, as an owner of something, if you can't do anything with it if you can't tell them what to. I mean, you could sell it. You can buy it.
Right.
You can get the dividends if they pay the dividends. You get the earnings if they get earnings. The earnings just go into appreciation unless they're paying dividends. So you don't get anything as far as any even voice in the room. And that was done by Facebook and by Google to keep the control with the founders. Well, that's cool. It makes sense. To some extent. The CEO at General Electric will make decisions even if the shareholders don't like it until they remove him from his job.
Which almost never.
Almost never happens. Right. So the idea that these non-voters might, be losing out on something, it's a little strange. Well, there's a new IPO coming out. It's for Snap. And Snap, in my mind, is not a lasting technology.
It's a drink, right?
It's not. It's a picture-taking app type situation.
Oh, this Snapchat.
It's from the concept of that, yes. So, okay. So think Twitter, think that sort of thing, only with an app that goes on whatever phone you have. Doesn't matter the platform. You've got the app, and it's just a software company. They're doing an initial public offering that is only offering non-voting share. That's the only public offering available is non-voting shares. And I wanted people to be aware that this sort of thing is taking place. There's a trend where it's getting harder and harder to maintain control of a founded company when other people invest in it. Well, my answer to that is, duh, you're using the money that people are giving you for ownership. They need something in return. If people go ahead and purchase these non-voting shares at Snap, to me, it's just a statement of they don't want to participate in the rights of an owner. To my mind, that's kind of un-American. If you're not getting into something and putting the money in there because you want to have some positive benefit come out of it, and you want to have some control of that positive benefit, then you may be an owner, but in essence, you're an employee. And the value of your shares doesn't have your voice at any point in the stage. So keep that in mind, that part of the reason that these share classes are coming out are because of the Dodd-Frank Act that limited the corporate structure in many ways. And so they're finding other ways of getting around that are, Dodd-Frank was supposed to be good for the public. And I don't think owning a bunch of shares where you don't have the right to vote is necessarily good for the public.
I want you to think, it's SNAP is the stock issue. It is the parent company of Snapchat.
Yes.
Snapchat is about all it does.
It's a software company.
And it loses money hand over fist and does not have a plan to make money. A viable plan to make money, and they expect to have $17.8 billion invested in their IPO.
Yep.
Let me tell you.
People may do it. They may pay that money, but if you're part of that, the only reason why you would do it is not to be part of the company, but to try to sell it at a profit later. Because you have no other reason for being involved. And people say, well, of course, that's why you buy stocks, to sell it at a profit later. Well, you hope you sell it at a profit later. At least with a voting right, you can show up at the meeting and let your voice be heard in some way.
This is my point. Buying a company that is losing money hand over fist acknowledges in its IPO that it is facing increasing competition and has a slower growth rate than it's ever had before.
This is why I said, among other things, is that Snapchat may not be something that lasts, and they're trying to figure out other things that they can do because their competition in the going away of pictures, you know, their whole claim to fame was, mm-hmm. you send a picture and then it disappears in a period of time.
Well, the whole idea in Snapchat, I think, is if you're going to vote, if you're going to buy shares in a company that's losing money and has no viable plan and whose product disappears,
well, you might as well not get a voting right anyway.
Who cares whether you get a vote?
So keep that in mind. The IPO market is back up and people are doing them again in larger numbers. And that means that our attitude as Americans and investors is good towards business at the moment. That's good news. Just be aware that there are some companies doing IPOs that you may not want to be involved in.
I like Barron's headline on the Snap IPO. It says, Snap's coming IPO looks like one to avoid.
Well, I guess other people agree.
You know, and I, you know, there are, the greater fool theory is in place, and apparently they expect to get a lot of people buy a lot of shares of Snap, and that means that the people who founded Snap will promptly sell their shares and become very, very wealthy in terms of dollars.
They're selling the shares to the people that are buying the shares, yeah, so they're going to come wealthy immediately.
We have this really worthless thing that's very popular and is losing money hand over fist, and we'd like to sell it to you.
Yes, but you don't get the right to vote on it. So, right. Yes, it seems a little bit shady to me.
Well, most, you know.
This will be a great study, though. This statement, if listen to this, folks. If this IPO does well,
mm-hmm.
if the Snap IPO really does well, it means that we're midway through the bull market. It means that we're not climbing a wall of worry anymore, because people do not invest $7+ billion in companies that are losing money and don't give them the right to vote unless they're no longer worried about losing their money.
It only lost $514 million last year on revenues.
Oh, that's all?
It lost that much on revenue of $404 million. And let's see, by the last quarter, it lost $169 million on the fourth quarter on $166 million. In other words,
somebody needs to tell them to remember where they put their money.
They're actually losing twice as much money as they have as revenue. In other words, they're for every dollar revenue they get, they're losing about $2.
It's really hard for me to figure that out. You know, I lost my toothbrush the other day.
You did?
Yeah. It's in my house. I didn't go anywhere and brush my teeth in the same place every day, multiple times a day. Why would I lose my toothbrush? Well, I have a 2-year-old daughter.
Ah.
So I lost my toothbrush.
You have the equivalent of Snapchat in
right.
a child.
I don't know how I would lose hundreds of millions of dollars.
Here's how you do it.
Unless you have a lot of 2-year-olds.
Here's how you do it. Are you familiar with Bob? I think it's – is it Bob the cucumber?
Bob the tomato.
Which one is the cucumber?
I can't remember. I don't know my VeggieTales very well.
But he goes around singing the song, Oh, Where Is My Hairbrush?
Oh, yes. Oh, Where Is My Hairbrush?
And you know what the answer to that question is? I didn't know that till very recently. My wife explained it to me. You don't have any hair, so you don't have a hairbrush.
Hmm.
Oh, where is my profits?
You don't have any profits.
You've never had any profits.
They don't exist.
Because you don't have anything to make a profit on.
Yes. So that just goes out to say, I like the beginnings of bull markets a lot because people are worrisome. They're aware that they need to be careful on where they put their money to make sure that there's good profits involved before they invest. It's when we get into googly land of make-believe where you just put your money anywhere and it makes money. That's scary. That means that we're on euphoria and that's the end of the bull because the crash comes after that. We're not there yet.
But you gotta look at the other side of this. I mean, a company that advertises itself as a camera company, and that's what they call themselves.
Oh, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where you take pictures that as soon as you look at them, they disappear.
Well, not as soon.
Very shortly after.
Very shortly thereafter, yeah.
That also, I mean, there was a company that did that. It's called Polaroid.
Well, they didn't disappear. They actually appeared as soon as you took them.
Well, they appeared shortly after you took them, but if you didn't coat them correctly, and sometimes even if you did coat them correctly, they would later disappear initially.
Oh, yes, that's
and
right.
Then ultimately, when's the last time you saw Polaroid as a viable company? I think it's gone.
Well, you can look it up. Kodak?
No, nobody
Kodak
bought it.
Kodak has the Polaroid stuff, right?
I think, no, Kodak didn't. Polaroid was a company all by itself, and I think it polarized right out of here. Anyway, I did want to talk about something else. Do you want to do commercials first?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
but I do want to talk about – I want to talk about something that's, I think, important if you're an investor, but we'll talk about it on the other side, okay?
All right. So if you'd like to call and join us, then the number in here to call is 254-773-1400.
And this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And this is Jeff, and I want to talk about something a little bit here, just a little bit, something like that.
You're
going
to talk about something a little bit,
bit? Okay, let's just presume the caller last hour who didn't get to call back was going to ask some things, but he did, and he did ask some things. Let's presume something. Let's presume that the tax law, as Speaker Ryan has proposed it, passes. And that law does a couple of things. Number one, it puts a 20 it does the you will pay taxes on, you don't get to deduct, if you're a corporation, you don't get to deduct the stuff you import, the cost of it,
or your interest on debt.
Well, I'm getting to that. Okay. And you also then will pay, you don't get to you don't have to pay your profit. In other words, if you make a profit on exporting something, you don't pay taxes on it. So that puts a 20% differential in there, and that's a I think that's probably a pretty good thing, by the way. The other thing that it does is it eliminates, in order to get the corporate taxes down from it, their current 35% maximum down to a 20% maximum, it eliminates the corporate income tax deduction on corporate debt. Now, that's big, but it has a very, very deep meaning for investors. If the companies that have jumped the most since the stock market took off have been growth companies. Now, year over year, the value companies are actually ahead. But in this last little bump upward, it's the high growth companies that have taken off rather than the value companies. Now, a growth company is one where people anticipate it's going to have higher earnings in the future. A value company is when people look at it and say, whoa,
it's worth a lot today.
We ought to buy that company because it's worth more than its stock is. Now, the value companies have not jumped because people are not looking real hard at them. Tech companies generally aren't value companies. But the value companies are the ones that have not borrowed a lot of money, even in the low interest rate environment. They have the attitude of, we ought not to have a lot of debt because the debt can go up in interest and we can get in a lot of trouble, so we ought to be conservative and stay out of debt. And as a result, the hot-to-trot investors who say, I want something that's going to shoot through the stratosphere, generally don't buy it. However, if the law changes, the tax law changes the way we just pointed out, where income taxes on profits drop, but the deductibility of interest on loans goes away, then suddenly the earnings of the growth companies will fall when they report them, their after-tax earnings.
Right.
And the earnings of the value companies will rise, and they will reverse position. So that's one of the things that is coming. I personally like the idea of a tax code that does not encourage corporations to borrow more money than they need, and that treats the interest on that loan like anything else. That's the cost you got to pay, guys. You don't get a tax write-off for borrowing a lot of money. And I think if you're a corporation, individuals, that's a different story. Small businesses is a different story. But for gigantic corporations, for example, Microsoft needed more money about like a hog needs a side saddle. They've got lots of money sitting in reserve, and they were floating big bond issues because interest rates were low.
There's a biggest example ever is Apple's 100-year bond issue.
I love it.
They have plenty of cash. They issued a full century maturity on their bond.
And why did they do that? Well, because interest rates were low and it was tax deductible. And because of the tax deduction,
it means the interest rates were even lower.
They literally you're paying them for the right to loan them money. Now, why people loaned Apple money for 100 years is beyond my comprehension, but there's a lot of things beyond my comprehension. I want to throw one thing in, and then Jake wants to jump on the same subject, I think. There's a good – the unemployment rate, we didn't even talk about the unemployment rate. It jumped from 4.7, jumped.
It's a big – it's a jump that is large enough that smallest, an inchworm would have said, oh, that was relatively high.
Yes. So it went from 4.7 to 4.8. And the same time, we wound up creating a lot more jobs than the economists had expected. Ooh, what's going on there? The reason that that happened, we basically employers hired 227,000 more people when the economists had only thought about 140. So there's about, there's something approaching 100,000 extra people in there got hired more than the economists thought, yet the unemployment rate went up. It went up to 4.8%. The reason is
more people are coming out and looking for jobs.
There's a percentage of people, basically there's a certain percentage of the people who could possibly working who are working. And it's like 62%. And it went from 62 to 60. So what happened is the percentage of people working who could work went up, and the unemployment rate went up because they just entered back into the job market. That means that the stimulus packages in the tax code have a good probability that they really will make the economy grow. Yardini says 10 to 20% growth without any additional earnings, if we just get the tax code, and without any change otherwise, if we get the tax code changes and the regulatory changes, we could see a 10 to 20% rise in the stock market during the next year or so.
Okay. All that's good stuff.
No promises there on the 10 to 20% rise. I'm just saying Ed Yardini. But Ed Yardini has been pretty right for a long period of time.
All right. I wanted to talk about unemployment because a lot of people have questions about it, including the president.
Me too, if I'm unemployed.
If you're unemployed, it feels like everybody's unemployed, and it feels like it's really hard to get work, because it is. It's not fun to be unemployed. That can be said as many times as you like, and the meaning is barely touched. So I'm going to say some numbers about movements here. So people talk about the participation rate. What does that mean? What is the participation rate? The participation rate is the measurement of the adult population. What does that mean? People above the age of 16 until there's no top age. Okay. The number of those people who want a job and are looking for a job. So that number is they want a job and they have attempted to look for a job or have a job within the last month. Okay. The participation rate right now in that large group of people is 62.9%. We'll call that 63. That means 37% of our adult population doesn't have a job. But the thing is, most of them are not looking for a job. Those are people that are, if you've got a 79-year-old retiree, well, they're not part of the labor force. That means they're not participating. If you've got a 17-year-old high school student or a 22-year-old college student that's not got a job, they're not participating, they're not looking, they're not part of the participation rate. So that's part of that 37%. If you solely look at the people that want a job, that's a harder number to get, because it's not asked very regularly. You can look at some other numbers, though. You can say people between the age of 25 and 54. People between the age of 25 and 54, the participation rate is like 89% in men. So this is comparable to what it's been throughout history with men. When people talk about the participation rate in men is falling, these are the numbers that we need to look at, because throughout history, people tended to work till they were dead, and they died a lot earlier. So they never left the participation force. They were always in it because there was no retirement.
Are you talking about me again?
No, you are definitely participating, and you're not dead.
Oh, okay.
So not talking about you. I could if you'd like.
All right.
There's a bald man in the room with me with a white beard.
There's a bald man in the room with me with a dark brown Blackbeard.
Yeah, well, see, we're talking about each other. At least I wasn't behind your back. Can you turn around a second? So anyway, the participation rate is one of those things that there's a lot of ways of looking at unemployment. There are people who are unemployed that want jobs but are no longer working. Well, that number is now right around 8%. At the height of the Great Recession, we were close to 20% there. So I'm rounding, but I figure that's better than going into great decimal lengths. The concept here is that we're a lot better off today than we were just a few years ago. And I'll give you an example. People not in the labor force that are part of this population, the people that are not participating, a year ago, 1 year ago in January of 2016, there were 94,036,000. This year in January, there's 94,366,000. So we've got about a $300,000 people that just left the labor force in the last year. Well, does that mean that there are less people employed? No, because another number here. This time last year, we had 252,397 people participating. These are people actually working. We have 254 million now. So we've got 2 million more people working and 300,000 more people not working. How did that? Well, the population's growing. So percentages are important. And when people talk to me about, well, look at all these numbers of people not working anymore, there's more people not working now than ever before. And I go, yes, then there's more people working now than ever before by a larger margin. So keeping in mind all of the moving pieces is part of the reason why people don't like economics in school. And hopefully we make it sound a little bit more exciting here. People that want to work generally can work if they can get the job by moving to it in the United States. Our unemployment rate is really a good number. The one that's put out there a lot is the people that within the last month have tried to get a job and who want a job now. So when we're talking about 4.8% of the population out there, of the working age population out there, those are the people that have said, we want a job and we're looking for one. And that helps people understand when we're talking about this. If somebody says that's an imaginary number, there are a lot of other numbers out there. All numbers, particularly when we're talking about symbolism for humanity, one does not represent a person, even as a number. It is an imaginary thing. It's a symbol. So yes, all of the unemployment rates are imaginary. But so is how many gallons you put in your gas tank, because it's just a big sloshing thing. So imaginary is one of those things where
and
statistics are dangerous. But
and there's an article in Forbes that says that, yes, the question is how much both the Secretary of the Treasury nominee, Mnuchin, and President Trump have said that the unemployment rate is wrong. It's too low. There's really more people unemployed. President Trump did say several times publicly that the unemployment rate is somewhere between 29 and 42%. No.
He may be just looking at the participation rate. But there are a lot of people that don't want to work that are not participating.
In that case, what he would say is that all the retired people should be counted in the unemployment numbers.
Well, you know, that's a good way to fix Social Security. If you're getting Social Security, we should just require you to go to work somewhere.
No, thank you. although I do draw Social Security and I am going to work somewhere. The thing that I think is important in the unemployment rate is that it be consistent.
I agree.
And we have a way of measuring it. There's all the way from U1 to U6.
Right.
If you want to go look at all the numbers, you can look at all the numbers.
We
you
use
can
U3 measure them usually. Yeah. That's the number that's most often reported.
And you can look up and down. But as long as we're always talking about U3, it's kind of like the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500 stock index.
They don't represent the whole market.
No,
but they're a good measurement, and we've been using them a long time.
Yeah. And measurement is really, really, really difficult when you're talking about things that move around a lot. And as long as we're consistent in using the same measurement over and over again, yeah, we're probably on track because we've got some idea what we're doing. And as much as the Commerce Department gets in the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Bureau of Labor Statistics gets berated, they do publish all those other employment rates if you want to go to their website, and they put it right out there.
Yeah, go
with their news release and everything else.
BLS.gov. And yes, you can nerd out for a while. We do. Yep. And we enjoy it. And I've got it open right here. I'm looking at the PDF and all these beautiful numbers, and other people's eyes glaze over and start drooling all over my computer. And I go, stop that.
Contrary to the politically popular, politically now becoming politically correct position that all government statistics are lies, there are people in the Bureau of Labor Statistics who work very, very hard at getting you an answer that fits the best with the reality that they're working with. And again, there are other answers. They publish them. There's one that we've kind of centered on as being the most representative of what's going on.
I'm going to give you one that's really goofy, just to let you know that even the goofy stuff is being measured. You remember during the Great Recession, if you had less than a high school diploma, man, you were not in good shape. And the people that were in best shape were bachelor's degree or higher. Well, the unemployment rate, if you have a bachelor's degree or higher right now, is 2.5%. It was 2.5% a year ago. It's been pretty flat at 2.5%. And I think that 2.5% is just the people going from one job to the next.
Yeah, it is.
Because the amount of time that they stay unemployed is much shorter as well. Okay, so here's where it gets goofy. If you have a high school graduate, if you've got a high school graduate, no diploma, the unemployment rate...
No, no diploma, but you
do have a diploma. I'm sorry, you have a diploma.
But that's, you don't have a degree.
No degree.
Right, you're cold.
The unemployment rate in that group is 7.7%.
Right.
That's a big number. The unemployment rate with people that have not graduated high school and are working, that are 25 years and older, or in that group, the unemployment rate there is 3.9%. So it's like you've got to double the people unemployed as a percentage if you got the diploma versus if you left early. But I find that goofy, and that tells you how much of a nerd I am. It means that people that didn't graduate high school have a lower unemployment rate.
Balance, your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.